This episode of Onward to Victory is proudly presented by our good friends at West Coast Screen Printing and Embroidery at wcscreens.com. You've heard their name for years now, and for good reason. If you have needs with screen printing, embroidery, customized promotional items for your company, organization, or more, head over to wcscreens.com and get with my friend Tony and the rest of his team. They have nationwide shipping, wholesale pricing, and exemplary customer service. Not only are they big supporters of this podcast, but, like you, they are also diehard fans of the Fighting Irish. Score a touchdown with wcscreens.com. And on with the show. You know, Notre Dame football history has been marked with coaches with long, successful tenures, some even breathtakingly so. Names like Rockne, Leahy, Parseghian, and Holtz are listed among the most prolific college coaches in history. But what about the guys who only served a season at the helm of the program, a single season? Believe it or not, there have been seven of those guys too. Though their time at the charge of the program may have been short, some of these men hold incredible significance for Notre Dame football. I'd go as far as to say some of their contributions were just as important as some of the famous coaches who came after them. So what are the stories here? Find out today. Buckle up those chin straps, Irish fans. This is Onward to Victory. Welcome to Onward to Victory, a Notre Dame football podcast. My name is Alex Painter, and welcome all to Chapter 95 of this humble show. Thank you for taking some time to be here today, and just to get a little bit flowery, which longtime listeners know I just love, every time you join Onward to Victory, you'll likely be embarking on an odyssey of some kind through the rich tapestry of Notre Dame football history, as this podcast strives to be the foremost destination for both Notre Dame football and history enthusiasts. I try to craft meticulous yet accessible narratives that celebrate the legacy, the triumphs, and the enduring spirit of the Fighting Irish. So there you have it. I have an offering today that, from the onset, might raise some questions. Perhaps the biggest is, why? Why spend an entire episode talking about those individuals who only spent a year at the helm of the football program? You'll soon pick up that the vast majority of these guys figured into the first quarter century or so of the program. So we'll be spending quite a bit of time pretty deep in the yesteryear. But as we will soon discuss, a one-year head coaching stint doesn't really scratch the surface of the depth nor breadth of some of these guys' impact on the university and the football program. Notre Dame football had a very, and I mean very, tenuous hold on what I would say relevance, but perhaps existence is a better word for these early days. So these guys, only if at charge for a single season, dutifully passed the baton to the next guy, which created some of the early sustainability around the program, and certainly created the web of infrastructure which would lend to future successes. So let me tell you really quickly, though, about this awesome tradition my family and I have. For the third year in running, we hit up the blue and gold game, the spring game, if you will. And let me tell you, it's become a highlight of our year. Now, weather in late April is always a bit of an adventure in northern Indiana, as many of us are keenly aware, but the day itself is just so family-friendly. $10 tickets, free parking. You really can't beat that. It's literally the only time we get to park in the stadium lot. And there are always activities for kids out in the concourses of the stadium. So we hit up Augie's and saw our good pal in Augie and also good friend Len Clark. That's Augie's locker room, of course. And we learned more about one of Len's current projects, which we'll surely talk about here on the show. But hey, if Notre Dame in the fall is cost prohibitive, or if you have smaller kids, I've been in both those places, I am here to tell you that the blue and gold game is kind of where it's at. So check out the Facebook page to see some of the pictures as I put some up there. Before we jump in, just a couple more housekeeping items. First, I hope you had a chance to listen to episode 94 released late last month. It was about the Seven Mules of Notre Dame. And listen, it's 2024. We are going to hear about the Four Horsemen, Notre Dame's uber famous backfield, and we are going to hear about them a lot. If you're listening to this podcast, I'd say there is a very strong chance you know just who these guys are, and of course that iconic picture. But what about the seven linemen who blocked for these guys? Those were the Seven Mules. Don't let them get lost to history here. Listen to episode number 94 today. They, being the Seven Mules, were really stinking good as well. In fact, the Horsemen often credited the Mules first for their successes. So listen to number 94 today. You surely won't regret it. The episode also features a potential origin story of the unit as far as how their name came about, which I had never heard before, and it was one from a primary contemporary source even. So check it out today. I'd sure appreciate it. And speaking of thank yous, a sincere acknowledgement here of the show's financial backers. We call them the Consensus All-Americans. These folks have either contributed significantly in the past or are currently donating to the show's efforts, and they are Dr. Jeremy Scarlett of Whitefish Bay, Wisconsin, Brad Glazier of Williamsburg, Indiana, author and writer Will Fuller of Warren, Ohio, Andy Nickel of South Bend, Indiana, and Michael Finan of Rutherford, New Jersey. If you yourself would like to chip in and make the prestigious muster roll of the Consensus All-Americans, please visit paypal.me/onwardtovictory if you're interested in a one-time donation, or patreon.com/onwardtovictorypodcast for monthly contributions. Thank you all. Of course, I'd also be remiss not to mention that this show is powered by West Coast Screen Printing and Embroidery at wcscreens.com. You've heard their name for years, so please jump over to them with any screen printing or embroidery needs for you, your organization, your company, your family reunion, whatever it might be. Also, this podcast is sponsored now also by Augie's Locker Room in South Bend, Indiana, the premier shop for Notre Dame memorabilia and gifts. Let me just tell you, no trip to campus would be complete without a stop at my good pal Augie's. One-of-a-kind items, gifts, and relics. He's even dedicating some space for museum-like exhibits along the back wall. It's just too cool. You gotta check it out. And he's now at a new location at 1733 North Ironwood Drive, which is just a stone's throw from the old location. But it is still the same Augie's that you know and love. Augie's Locker Room. Okay, so let's set the stage once more. We're going to talk about seven men who served as Notre Dame head football coach for exactly one campaign, one season. As we will find out, some of these tenures qualify as head coach. I'm using head coach in air quotes in a looser sense than others, but this was the nature of college football, particularly if you were at an institution like Notre Dame, whose program was relatively unstable for much of the first couple decades of its existence, or it kind of had more of a recreational feel as opposed to an intercollegiate feel. Some of the men we will talk about more than others, but all will get their time in the sun. Now, admittedly, I really, really enjoy talking about this era of Notre Dame football, so hopefully this will also pique your interest as well. That is, if you aren't already an early Notre Dame football junkie like myself. But as a quick caveat, we aren't going to count short-term interim coaches, or, say, George O'Leary, who didn't coach it at all at Notre Dame despite being hired. That should probably be an episode, honestly, one of these days. Now, first up on the docket, we are heading to 1894. And actually, this was the first person to be named to the role of head coach in Notre Dame football history. So here we go, 1894. Be mindful that the sport was first played on an intercollegiate basis on Notre Dame's campus in 1887 and 1888 with a pair of games against Michigan. So the first formal head coach for the program was a chap named James L. Morrison. I'll say this much. Of all the major accounts and histories of Notre Dame football I traditionally use for this podcast, there is nary a single one that has much of a mention of Morrison, if any at all. However, I reached for a more specific reference, given the subject matter here. A gentleman named John Crick, K-R-Y-K, wrote an account called Natural Enemies about Notre Dame and Michigan's rivalry. I snapped that particular book off the shelf because Morrison was sent to Notre Dame from Michigan. Yes, so the soon-to-be bitter gridiron rivals were actually on pretty friendly terms, especially early on. Again, so much so that Michigan, in a sense, furnished Notre Dame their first full-time head coach. And Notre Dame paid Morrison, so it was a formal role. A total of $40 plus expenses for 2 weeks. Now, Morrison, while he was at Michigan, picked up a very strong affinity towards conditioning and speed as keys to winning a football game. You know, like the physical fitness aspect that we just expect around the sport. But he brought that to Notre Dame, and he actually kind of found some pushback from the current players. So for a quick timeline here, Morrison arrived on campus on October 6, 1894. At his first practice, he noted in a letter to an acquaintance that, quote, "I am afraid we will get swiped unmercifully as I have set hard to train. They want to smoke cigarettes, and when I told them that they have to run to get up some wind, they thought I was rubbing it in on them," end quote. Morrison continued, quote, "I had one big strong cuss remark that practice was too much like work," end quote. So Morrison at least won them over enough to beat Hillsdale College 14-0 on October 13th, and then they tied Albion College on October 20th 6-6. So Morrison, who was a Michigan guy, squared off against two Michigan opponents while he was head coach at Notre Dame. Oh, and really quick, just to give a fair and balanced and authentic account, in that letter where Morrison was complaining to his pal that the Notre Dame football players only wanted to smoke cigarettes and had no interest of running, he did comment that the campus was one of the most beautiful places he had ever seen in his life. So Morrison was really taken aback by Notre Dame's campus, even if he had a little bit of frustration with the football team. But truly showing a sign of the times, after that second game, that game against Albion, Morrison defected back up north and ran the Hillsdale college football team for the rest of the season, where he guided them to a 3-2 record. So yes, that same Hillsdale team that his Notre Dame team had beat, he ultimately coached for the rest of the year. So how about that? Notre Dame's first head coach, James L. Morrison, stuck around for his contracted 2 weeks, and then finished out the year with another program. So I apologize, I used the term defected earlier. Maybe that was a little harsh, because he did stick around for his two-week contract. But yeah, he did, and then he finished out the season with a team that his team had already beaten. So that was the wild and woolly times in college football during this era. But Notre Dame defeated Wabash and Rush Medical School before losing to Albion the last game of the season after tying with them earlier. So the team that year finished with 3 wins, 1 loss, and 1 tie. It was during the last four games of that season that Notre Dame once more did not have a formal head coach. That was 1894. The following year, yet another Michigan product came to Notre Dame for just a single season. And really, just like his predecessor Morrison, it was ultimately less than a season. We are talking about Harry Graydon Haddon, or H.G. Haddon for short. Now, he was actually supposed to play at Michigan once more during the 1895 season. At the last minute, he kind of decided to jump ship and join the Chicago Athletic Association, who then went on a football tour on the East Coast during the traditional college season. And Michigan was kind of pissed because Haddon had told them that his parents didn't want him to leave Chicago, and that's why he was staying in the city. That was clearly a mistruth. But lo and behold, he had actually also promised Notre Dame that he would coach their squad that season as well. So he kind of welched on not one deal, which was to play for Michigan that year, but two deals, which the other one was to coach Notre Dame. And Notre Dame was far from pleased. And Notre Dame was not super shy about their displeasure as well. In the October 26, 1895 issue of the school newspaper called The Scholastic, it was shared that Haddon had broken his contract to coach the varsity to go on that Eastern tour with the Chicago Athletic Association. And it was reported that, quote, "Mr. Haddon is far from scrupulous in his business dealings," end quote. Ouch. In the next week's issue, they weren't done. They were still dragging Haddon a little bit. Quote, "Haddon was engaged for the season, but saw it fit to break his contract," end quote. So, you know, once you put some words in writing and the ink is dried, you can't really take them back. But somehow, Haddon wasn't deterred by the fact he was being besmirched in the Notre Dame press, and he did ultimately arrive on campus on November 11th, 1895, which somewhat ended the saga. And if you're thinking November 11th is really late for a head coach to just arrive to be with a football team, you would be correct, actually. It is late. He only coached the team at practice for a couple weeks, but he also transferred to the school also to study law. This is just kind of a mess. But he was at the helm of the program for exactly one game, Haddon was. And that was against the Indianapolis Light Artillery. That's a common opponent in the early days of the program. And a lot of folks might look at that like, Indianapolis Light Artillery? Yeah, it was an Indianapolis-based team who, kind of a militia type, who formed their own football team. And they played schools like Notre Dame quite frequently. But his Notre Dame team actually lost 18-0. And Haddon, who was again coaching from the sidelines, got a little frustrated and inserted himself in the game at left tackle and even put himself in the backfield for a few carries. H.G. Haddon may be credited with Notre Dame's 3-1 record in 1895, but he himself was actually 0-1. You kind of find some of these things quite frequently in the Notre Dame media guide and a lot of the Notre Dame histories. If a coach was there, they're kind of credited with the whole season worth of games, but Haddon himself was there for a loss against the Indianapolis Light Artillery. He is considered a head coach formerly in the program record, so we acknowledge him here, but he was really only there for one game, and that one game he actually did indeed play in. So, H.G. Haddon, the second head coach of the Irish, kind of. He is still credited again with coaching the full season and in the media guide and program histories. So here we go. Morrison, 1894. Haddon, 1895. And now we vault forward four whole years to 1899. In between those years, the program is led by a gentleman named Frank E. Herring, who we have talked about on the show before and is essentially the first true head coach in program history, as he held the position for 3 years and really began making a concerted effort to scheduling legitimate opponents, So say not like the Indianapolis Light Artillery or local high schools, much more frequently. So there's an episode about him, by the way. But my estimation, though, the next guy we are covering is one of the unsung heroes of the first couple decades of Notre Dame football. And that would be 1899 head coach James McWeeny. If I were to pick one head coach in Notre Dame history who I really wouldn't want to pick a fight with, yeah, you guessed it. It was McWeeny. He was a tough cookie, man. Notre Dame player, coach, historian, and archivist Chet Grant, who also has his own episode, by the way, remembers one time McWeeny was out coaching a local high school team. So this would have been after his stint at Notre Dame. But while coaching up the high school backfield, he gave them some, we'll call it, unconventional wisdom when he encouraged them that after they received the handoff, to hit the line with their open fist clenched, as if he was going to slug someone. He said, quote, "You won't have to use it. Your opponents will get the message," end quote. So that may have been a pretty good encapsulation of Coach McWeeny right there. He had a ton of toughness and moxie, and his players kind of personified it as a result. But McWeeny was born in 1866, and he joined the Chicago Police Force in 1890. So this was after he had left home to sell farming machinery in the Dakota Territories. In nearly a decade with the Chicago PD, he was promoted a couple times, but he really made a name for himself as an amateur boxer and one of the very best Greco-Roman wrestlers in the entire country. Like our man Haddon, McWeeny also suited up for the Chicago Athletic Association football team. And it's really likely that McWeeny and Haddon were teammates during that 1895 season when Haddon had skipped out on both his commitments to Michigan and to Notre Dame. But for the Chicago Athletics, McWeeny played mostly offensive guard and along the defensive line. But McWeeny never played a down of college football. Now, I checked my math on this, but still, let's call this one a little unofficial. But McWeeny was the only Notre Dame head football coach to have not played college football for 106 years. 106 years. He was joined in this very exclusive club by Charlie Wise in 2005, who also didn't play college football. Brian Kelly played club football at Division II Assumption University, so for the purposes of this, we will count that. But there you go. Two head coaches who didn't play college football, Charlie Wise and James McWeeny. So speaking of him becoming head coach, he accepted the role at Notre Dame ahead of the 1899 season, and he also enrolled in Notre Dame's law school as well. Not picking up on this, the law school was actually kind of a draw for Notre Dame during this era. But McWeeny had one heck of a year as head coach. The team went 6-3-1, but they did log victories over larger schools, such as Northwestern. And they scored a 17-0 victory over Indiana University. And it was the first time in school history that Notre Dame had defeated her in-state rival. But 1899 was McWeeny's only season at the helm. He was succeeded the following year by Australian Pat O'Day. Episode also about his interesting time at Notre Dame as well. But McWeeny stuck around the program. So when O'Day departed in 1901 after two seasons, McWeeny was always coming back to help coach the linemen. And it was a huge help as the program from 1902 through 1904 was always a bit in flux as it pertained to coaches. More on that, actually, in just a minute. But he was always around to help. And it was made a bit easier because he had actually joined the South Bend Police Department. He actually served as the police chief from 1902 through 1910. So he was always around, and like I said, always willing to help, and he was a supporter of the program for the rest of his days. though he did eventually move back to Illinois. On December 11th, 1941, just a few days after the attack on Pearl Harbor and the United States being drawn into World War II, he was in an automobile accident, and he died of his injuries about 2 weeks later. James McWeeny was a public servant, one hell of an athlete, and a very underrated head coach and early supporter of Notre Dame football. Which takes us to 1904, with, in my opinion, one of the greatest Notre Dame football players relative to his peers. Almost up there with the infamous George Gipp, and that is fullback Louis Salmon, famously nicknamed Red. Lou would have just missed McWeeny. He came to Notre Dame as a student in 1900. So again, he just missed him as a head coach, but he would know him very well. And this much can be said about Lou. He was Notre Dame's greatest football player from 1887 until George Gipp's senior year in 1920. So let's say the greatest in the first over three decades of the program. And I will say it wasn't even close. He was named to Walter Camp's All-American list. He was the first Notre Dame football player to be named to this prestigious list. And he was named in 1903 when he was a senior. His 36 rushing touchdowns stood as a program record for almost 80 years. He's still sixth in points scored in program history, and be mindful, touchdowns were only worth 5 points in his day. Anyway, I'm writing Lou's biography, spoiler, and I am very, very motivated to reclaim his place in Notre Dame football history. But Lou was a Syracuse guy. And as I mentioned, he came to Notre Dame to study civil engineering in 1900. This was after he took a turn at Mount St. Mary's and tried out the seminary. It wasn't really his cup of tea, but he did find his way to the football field. In 1902 and 1903, you may notice in the media guides and many program histories that the role of Notre Dame football head coach was filled by a man named James Farragher. Now, I have talked about this on the show before, and this is not to disparage Farragher, who was an excellent tackle for the blue and gold, but his being named head coach couldn't be farther from the truth. A look into contemporary or primary sources will quickly tell you that it was Lou Salmon who was organizing practice, recruiting players from the Interhall League, keeping a watchful eye over that Interhall League, and even speaking to the media like the program's head coach during this time. Lou was doing it, not James Farragher. Lou was captain, and for him at that time, that meant he essentially was player head coach. Now, yeah, he'd pull in Police Chief McWeeny and others for some practices before big games to kind of help run a more efficient practice, and like I said, McWeeny would help with the linemen. Lou was in the backfield and a linebacker. But that was about it. I mean, this includes the 1903 season when Lou was named Notre Dame's first All-American and the team was unbeaten and unscored on. So I'm pretty hell-bent about fixing this. Lou should be named the head coach for 3 seasons, but for the purpose of this episode, Lou is considered a 1-year head coach. But again, he ought to have 3 seasons under his belt. So after his playing days were over, okay, so he played 1900, 01, 02, and 03. And again, 03, he was a All-American, and that team was unbeaten and unscored on. He transitioned to the formal head coach role in 1904. And I will be the first to tell you, his tenure as head coach was not super successful. The team went 5-3 that year. They clearly missed Lou as a player. Lou lived a quiet yet very successful life after he graduated. He indeed became a civil engineer, and he worked on many large projects. He played a season of early professional football with the Massillon Tigers shortly after he graduated. And you know what? He reputedly only came back to campus twice for the rest of his life. He was very humble, very unassuming, and likely didn't want folks to kick up a major fuss about him. This undoubtedly probably plays a role in why he's been largely forgotten or glossed over as one of Notre Dame football player's greats. He didn't really stoke his ego or his legacy much, but he did return to campus on homecoming 1920 to see George Gipp play. Lou was inducted to the College Football Hall of Fame shortly after his death. But don't worry, this podcast will be covering Lou in deeper detail soon. Lou was succeeded in 1905 by a gent named Henry McGlue, who was nicknamed Fuzzy due to his wavy hair. So Fuzzy was a friend and teammate of Lou's, and Fuzzy was quarterback in the same backfield that Lou lined up at fullback. Fuzzy was an Irish immigrant and was actually one of the few Notre Dame football players at this time who had actually played football in high school. And he was a solid player. He reputedly never fumbled during, and if that's true, it's really impressive. And even more impressive when you consider how many fumbles there were in the game at that time. So Fuzzy's record in 1905 was 5-4. And that season, again, 1905, was rather unspectacular. They pretty much beat who they should have and lost to their major opponents in Indiana, Purdue, and Wisconsin. And that fourth loss, you might be thinking, or wondering, I should say, they also dropped their game 5-0 to Wabash, Wabash College. So if there are any Wabash men in the listening audience, there's one for you. 1905 scored a victory over Notre Dame. Quick recap. Morrison, 1894. Haddon, 1895. McWeeny, 1899. Salmon, 1904. And McGlue, 1905. So we have two more. The next one takes us to 1908. A gentleman named Victor Place, better known as Vic. When Vic arrived on campus in 1908, he was by far the most seasoned head coach Notre Dame football had ever had. He had coached from 1903 through 1905 at Ohio Wesleyan University in the Columbus, Ohio area. Actually, Ohio Wesleyan is a team I played twice in college in 2008 and 2009. They are now called, and have been called for quite some time, the Battling Bishops. I'm not quite sure what they were called 12 decades ago, but there's that. At any rate, Vic had coached 3 years at Ohio Wesleyan, and then had actually coached 2 years at the University of Washington. Now, even in just the three seasons between McGlue in 1905 and Place in 1908, the game of football had changed some. There were grave concerns over the safety of the game, and those concerns had hit a fever pitch. And there were rules put in place to make the game safer. In fact, President Teddy Roosevelt, who was an ardent football fan, actually got involved himself. But this included legalizing the forward pass, making the game a little bit shorter, the implementation of a neutral zone. A fourth referee was added to help regulate and police the game. And now 10 yards were needed for a first down. The idea was to spread out the game a little bit to avoid the constant rugby-like scrums right in the middle of the field, which were costing players literally their lives. And there were tons of just catastrophic injuries at this time. But Coach Place really didn't care for the new rules. He preferred what was called power football. Let's scrum it up. Move the ball, still that de facto hand-to-hand combat, if you will, in the trenches. He was also notorious for his long practices. Perhaps some of you football players out there had a coach like this in high school or college. He ran guys through two-a-days that would be over 6 hours long, total. Just brutal. And again, we aren't too terribly far removed from one coach, James Morrison, having to tell his guys they couldn't smoke cigarettes during practice. But Coach Place did know football, even if he kind of still adopted some of the previous tactics. He had been an All-American player at Dartmouth, which was a really strong football school at that time. And they actually still compete very well in the Ivy League conference to this day. Coach Place's crew went 8-1, so a very successful season. Their only loss was a 12-6 road defeat to Michigan. Though they didn't have a super grueling schedule that season, they did beat Indiana fairly handily. And you know, I never could find out why Coach Place left after just one season, but he did. Vic actually ultimately left football altogether, and he began his law career in Oregon and Seattle, Washington. Sadly, Coach Place was killed on June 16, 1923 in Brookings, Oregon, as a result of a logging accident. He was 46 years old. And finally, we have number 7, Edward McKeever. This one actually may ring some bells. He attended Notre Dame in the early 1930s before transferring to Texas Tech, where he played varsity football. Ed had actually suited up for the freshmen during his time at Notre Dame. He played halfback for the freshman team, and he met a fellow student named Frank Leahy during his time at Notre Dame. This would prove to be an important relationship. After the men's playing careers were over, McKeever actually joined Leahy on his staff at Boston College in 1930 and 1940. Of course, that 1940 season at Boston College was a special one. The team went 11-0 and won the Sugar Bowl. At this time, Elmer Layden, who was a four horseman, mind you, was actually cycling out of his tenure at Notre Dame as head coach, which is probably a nice way to say he was asked to leave. But the powers that were at Notre Dame at the time then plucked one of their own in Leahy from Boston College to coach the Irish. Leahy brought McKeever with him to coach his backfield. When Coach Leahy was called to the Navy ahead of the 1944 season, this was during World War II, mind you, of course, it was McKeever who was named interim. Now, yeah, I know I said earlier, no interims. But since McKeever was at the helm for the entire 1944 season, we will grant an exception. So he was a long-term interim as opposed to many of the short-term interims we have seen during our time with Notre Dame football. But in 1944, the Irish went 8-2, so fairly respectable, and they finished with a top 10 ranking. The Associated Press gave them the number 9 ranking after the season had ended, and they did spend some time at number 1. Their only two losses that year were against Army and Navy. This is an interesting quirk since, again, it was during wartime. But at any rate, though the Irish experienced some success that year in 1944, perhaps the most notable event of the season was the fact they suffered their worst loss in program history, a 59-0 shellacking at the hands of Army at Yankee Stadium. Now, that loss proved pretty embarrassing for Notre Dame football, and actually, it spelled the end, essentially, of McKeever's time in South Bend. He moved on to become the head coach at Cornell after his season at Notre Dame, and he remained in football for nearly the rest of his life. He dabbled in professional football and other stints in college football, but there you have it. If you were to tally up the record of all of the one-year wonders, if you will, they win a combined 38 wins, 15 losses, and 2 ties, which was still near a 71% winning percentage. So, not too shabby there. I sure hope you did enjoy this latest offering of Onward to Victory, a Notre Dame football podcast. If you like the show, head over to Facebook and like the Facebook page. Send the show an email at onwardtovictorypodcast@gmail.com. I try to read every email on the air. 2024 marks the 5th anniversary of the show, so we're kind of going to try to start celebrating that a little bit more here in the coming months, as the show was formally launched in June of 2019. So we're coming up again on that 5 years. So stick with us. It's going to be a fun rest of 2024. And thank you once more to the Consensus All-Americans, Dr. Jeremy Scarlett, Brad Glazier, Will Fuller, Michael Finan, and Andy Nickel. Thanks once more to West Coast Screen Printing and Embroidery. You can find them at wcscreens.com. And of course, Augie's Locker Room in South Bend, Indiana. This has been Onward to Victory, a Notre Dame football podcast. And in kindness, I am your host, Alex Painter. And as always, friends, go Irish!